Good evening and welcome to Night of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
He knows that those guys appointed him. He's there because of them, and then he cannot say anything. And they left him with the rebels. How can you discuss with the rebels, and those rebels has been instrumentalized by some neighboring countries?
Democratic Republic of Congo's main opposition party calls for an independent investigation into a protest crackdown by security forces.
Trying to create an impression that these law enforcement agencies, such as the Anti-Corruption Commission and the Zamba Police, the Drug Enforcement Commission, have only started working now after the change of government, is what we find surprising.
Zambia's Anti-Corruption Commission seizes vehicles from the main opposition party, the Patriotic Front, or PF.
This can be 2 to 5 years or whatever, 1 year, they will still have something to say. I can also see that the same people that are in favor of the government are still supporting the government are satisfied with the 2 years. That's what I have noticed so far on the social medias.
And Mali's military junta launches a 24-month transition plan that will lead to elections. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The Democratic Republic of Congo, the main opposition Engagement for Citizenship and Development Party, is calling for an independent investigation into a protest crackdown by security forces. The crackdown saw the arrest of protesters and left several injured. Members of the party were protesting near parliament, demanding new measures to ensure the next general election is peaceful. This, as the UN office in the DRC also condemned what it says was the excessive use of force by law enforcement during the demonstration. Martin Fayulu is the leader of the Engagement for Citizenship and Development Party. He tells me that the violence against peaceful protesters is unacceptable. He is also calling for those responsible to face the full force of the law.
Yes, our party members were demonstrating today in front of the National Assembly because we want the law on the electoral law to be discussed together. We have to have a consensus on that law, the consensus among all stakeholders outside the National Assembly before the law to be discussed in the Assembly. Our people went there, many, almost 2,000 people, and the policemen came and they shoot the police and the militaries, and they shoot our people. And as our headquarters is not far from the National Assembly, they followed our people to our headquarters. They shoot them. Some of them are badly injured. They are in the hospital now. 22 injured, 2 with the bullet in their in them.
Mr. Fayulu, some people are saying that trying to force the lawmaking body to discuss issues of paramount concern to your party is the wrong way to go. Instead of presenting a petition to lawmakers from your party to raise those issues in parliament, why should they go demonstrating and causing troubles?
We cannot raise the issue in the parliament because the parliament is one side. They will go there and they will make the law as they want because they have a large majority. We cannot go and discuss there. Since 2004, all main laws are discussed outside the parliament among the all stakeholders, and then we bring the law to the parliament, and then the parliament take it and discuss and then make the law. But we cannot today. All the parliamentaries, both by Tshisekedi, will not have any success on that.
So why would they carry out such an activity that people find illegal?
We just want to stop the fraud, because Mr. Felix Tshisekedi, he appointed judges in the constitutional courts on July 17, 2020, and then he appointed a member of the Electoral Commission, a member of his party, and now he's trying to just pass the law that he will use that law, then the 2023 election will be like the 2018. That's the thing that we don't want. We want a credible election. We want everybody to agree on what we will do. Everybody has to agree on the law so we can have a peaceful election. We can have an impartial election and a credible election.
The president has launched a joint offensive between the FARDC, the Congolese Army, and the UPDF, Ugandan Army, to go after ADF rebels. He also brought up the issue of security at the recent East Africa Regional Heads of State, where East Africa has agreed to send in troops to try to have and maintain law and order among issues and chase armed groups. Why don't you think this is enough to help the country security-wise?
But it's not enough. He signed an agreement with President Museveni, okay, with his military and so on and so forth. What is the result of that? The Congolese continue to be killed. There is nothing he can achieve. He went to the meeting in Nairobi, in that meeting, and then the other guys, they impose him to discuss with the rebel groups, and they, as a president, they leave him alone to discuss with rebels. Can you agree that? Can you accept that? He doesn't have any means to fight or to argue because he knows that those guys appointed him. He's there because of them, and then he cannot say anything. And they left him with the rebels. How can you discuss with the rebels, and those rebels has been instrumentalized by some neighboring countries?
Martin Fayulu is the leader of DRC's main opposition, the Engagement for Citizenship and Development Party. He spoke with me from the capital, Kinshasa. Zambia Anti-Corruption Commission says it has seized over 71 vehicles from the main opposition party, the Patriotic Front. This as the anti-graft agency embarks on a drive to weed out corruption in the Southern African country. But the PF says the seizure is politically motivated and aimed at weakening the party's ability to campaign across the country. It also says it's illegal for any government institution to demand a political party to disclose its source of funding. For reaction and the latest development, I reached Stephen Kabiungu. He is the minority chief whip of the main opposition Patriotic Front in the Zambian parliament.
Yes, indeed, I can confirm that some of our party motor vehicles were confiscated from some of our party operatives in different parts of the country. And what has happened now is that the Anti-Corruption Commission, who we can only assume are now working with the Zambia Police Service through what they are calling a joint investigation team, issued a notice to the public listing some of the vehicles which were confiscated from the party that they intend to forfeit them to the state if they are not claimed.
But is your party cooperating with the ongoing investigation?
The party has been cooperating. All the senior members of our party who have been summoned to be questioned by the Anti-Corruption Commission have made themselves available because most of them have been cited in their individual capacity. Yeah, but even these vehicles that they've been confiscating from our members, we have been just waiting for communication. Yeah, but you may wish to know, Peter, that in our country, there's no law that compels political parties to disclose their support in terms of resources, and how they acquire property. There's no law. We had this situation before as Patriot Front when we formed government. I think there were some suspicions of similar nature against the movement for multi-party democracy, MND. A number of vehicles were impounded. But these matters were taken to court, and there is a ruling to that effect, which confirms that in the absence of the law, which compels political parties to disclose their sources of income, it was ruled that the vehicles be returned to the movement for multi-party democracy.
Stephen, if there's an ongoing investigation by the joint efforts of the Anti-Corruption Commission and the police, and they suspect that the vehicles were purchased with proceeds of crime, shouldn't they act?
Well, this is what I'm saying, Peter. It's a very interesting one. First of all, it would have been prudent for them to, you know, effective investigations must be done systematically, okay? And if people are independently applying themselves, the investigations must have been done. And to point that, okay, there was some money that was stolen, government resources that were stolen from this point, which were then utilized to procure these motor vehicles. You understand?
Stephen, you said your party is cooperating. Some of the individuals who are alleged to have committed all kinds of financial improprieties and allegations of corruption. But some of your party members are also saying the charges against them or allegations against them are politically motivated. So how can you be cooperating at the same time casting aspersion at the only constitutionally mandated organization to investigate acts of corruption?
I understand, Peter. You also must understand that even when we were in government, we knew that our colleagues who were in opposition then had received some motor vehicles. There are some Mahindra motor vehicles which are Indian made, which they received a freight. No one cared to say, look, you where have you getting these vehicles? You know, so it's individuals that are being courted. The individuals that have been summoned to go and answer for the investigations are ready to go to the court. But what they are saying is, are these law enforcement agencies start operating now? You also may recall, Peter, that during our time, our president was not shielding anyone. You do remember that there were some of our serving ministers who were subject to investigations, and they were made to go through the process up to the court of law. You understand? So now, to try and create an impression that these law enforcement agencies, such as the Anti-Corruption Commission and the Zambia Police, the Drug Enforcement Commission, have only started working now after the change of government, is what we find surprising.
Stephen Kampiongo is the minority chief whip of the main opposition Patriotic Front in the Zambian Parliament. He spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. The military junta says it has launched a 24-month transition plan that will lead to elections. The move is generating mixed reaction. Analysts say the plan sharply contradicts demands by Economic Community of West African State, or ECOWAS, a regional bloc. It's demanding a 12 to 16-month transitional period before elections are organized. ECOWAS imposed sanctions on Mali following the military takeover last year. It has a zero tolerance for the forceful overthrow of a legitimately elected government. For reaction and the latest development in Mali, I reached the CEO of Tigana Technology, a tech company, Salif Tigana, in the capital, Bamako.
So far, I have not seen much reaction from the political parties, except one of them, that is Musa Amara's political party, that is called Yelema. Yesterday, I heard from them that they urged the government to move forward and go faster to come up with a plan that will help government to ease the sanctions or whatever struggle we're going through right now. So as far as the population is concerned, the government has a lot of supporters in the Mali right now. You understand, because they're trying to do something. We see that in security front. They are trying to do something. They're trying to do something. And that's the reason why the population still have, they still have the population's support. Now we are going to just expect what the politicians are going to say in the next 2-3 days. But so far, nobody is saying anything. We're just waiting for the prime minister to come up with the plan.
But isn't 24 months too long? Because some people are suggesting that that sharply contradicts what ECOWAS wants to be done between 6 months and 12 months. 24 months is too long. That might not necessarily ease the sanctions.
Yeah, I guess it wants to help to ease the sanctions. But I think I heard the prime minister saying yesterday in House of Parliament that if he did not come up with a plan so far, it's because he was giving a chance to negotiation with the ECOWAS. But since the negotiations are not going forward, then Mali is going to come up with a plan, his own plan. So, yeah, I don't think it's going to be easy, but it's negotiation. We're going to go. Maybe what about the Burkina Faso model? What about the Guinea model? They took whatever is necessary to do their transition. So now Mali may be looking at something like that and say, okay, so we're going to just pick up our own date and we're going to go with that. And he even emphasized that the 2 years is not negotiable. He said that it's not negotiable.
But Salif, are Malians prepared to withstand or cope with the sanctions imposed by ECOWAS and how it is affecting their daily lives? Are they ready for it to endure these 24 months of imposed sanctions before elections are organized?
Maybe we don't have a choice if this is what the government chooses to do. Anyway, they have to come up with some plan, because we cannot stay in that stage of a negotiation where we're not going forward, we're not moving backward. So something has to be done, and picking 2 years to go forward, and then we are going just to see what the ECOWAS is going to say. If ECOWAS is going to put the more sanctions, I think it's going to be very hard. I think it's going to be very hard for the population, because for now, we can see that things are going higher price and life is getting a little bit hard. Despite the Malian are resilient, despite the population are totally supportive of the government.
Salif, will you say the youth on social media are also supporting the 24-month transitional period?
Well, I think the youth in social medias are very divided in that issue, because it depends on what side you are. As in Bamako, most of the young people are part of the political parties. So it depends on if you are, whether you are part of the opposition or you're part of the party that are supporting the transition. But I can see the same people that are against the government so far since the transition started are still against the transition. So this can be 2-5 years or whatever, 1 year, they will still have something to say. I can also see that the same people that are in favor of the government are still supporting the government are satisfied with the 2 years. That's what I have noticed so far on the social medias.
Salif Tigana is the CEO of Tigana Technology, a tech company. He spoke with me from the Malian capital, Bamako. Meanwhile, Mali's prime minister says Mali will renew the UN support mission in the country, even as UN efforts to investigate alleged human rights abuses are denied by Mali's military government. For VOA, Annie Reisenberg reports from the Malian capital, Bamako.
The town of Mora was the site of a military operation in which witnesses say the Malian army and foreign soldiers summarily executed hundreds of civilians. Prime Minister Choguel Kokola Maiga says he recognizes the hesitancy that some countries have expressed in continuing to contribute troops to the UN mission in Mali. His speech was posted on state TV station ORTM's Facebook page.
Le renouvellement du mandat de l'aménagement serait attendu.
He says the renewal of MINUSMA's mandate is expected in June 2022, and there should not be a significant change in the mandate, even though some countries that are contributing troops suggest they will reassess their level of participation. Several European military operations have been halted in Mali in recent months, including the Takuba Task Force, the European Union Training Mission, and France's Operation Barkhane, following tensions with Mali's government and accusations that Mali's forces are working with Russian mercenaries employed by the Wagner Group. Several European countries contribute troops to MINUSMA. The announcement comes as the UN has been continually denied access to investigate human rights abuse allegations in the village of Mora. In March, there were several reports of Malian and foreign soldiers, presumed to be Russian mercenaries, carrying out summary executions of civilians in Mora, in what Human Rights Watch called the worst single atrocity reported in Mali's decade-long armed conflict. Aliane Teen, an independent UN expert on human rights in Mali, released a statement calling for a prompt investigation. Using a messaging app from Senegal, he expressed optimism at MIGA's announcement, but said the tension between France and Russia playing out in Mali is not conducive to resolving Mali's security crisis. If we have, he says, a space of polarization, of tension between the big powers, I don't think this is good for Mali, not for all of the Sahel, not even for all Africans. Andrew Leibovich is a Sahel analyst at the European Council on Foreign Relations. Speaking from New York via a messaging app, he said that MINUSMA's mission is conflicted.
There's a possible contradiction here where MINUSMA is supposed to be supporting the transitional government, supporting the state, but also potentially investigating the state and protecting civilians in some cases from the state. And this is something that the mission is going to struggle to deal with, frankly, especially if the current pattern of alleged human rights abuses continues.
MINUSMA also expressed concern about recent human rights abuse allegations in Homburdi, saying in a tweet that it has the intention of visiting the scene soon. Both Teen and Leibovich say it's rare or unheard of for the Malian government to refuse to grant UN investigators access to a site. Annie Reisenberg for VOA News, Bamako, Mali.
Of Africa is suffering a historic drought that the UN says could result in starvation for as many as 20 million people. In Ethiopia, more than 7 million people are already short of something to eat, suffering compounded by the war in the north. For VOA, Harry Wilkins reports from the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa.
A fourth consecutive year of failed rains is causing the worst drought in the Horn of Africa since 1981. Meanwhile, the UN's World Food Programme tells VOA a combination of conflict in the north of Ethiopia and drought in the south are set to be catastrophic for the country. WFP spokesperson Claire Neville says the worst effects could be averted if action is taken quickly, but that doesn't look likely.
In the 2016 to 2017 drought, this catastrophe was avoided through early action. In 2022, due to a severe lack of resourcing, there are growing fears that it won't be possible to prevent the looming disaster.
A policy advisor for a major humanitarian donor to Ethiopia, who declined to be named, told VOA that the government's focus was on the war and mobilisation for it, so there was significant lag time in doing the assessments and putting in place the response mechanisms for the drought in the south. The advisor said the cost of that inattention was a huge loss of livelihoods, assets and livestock. The advisor noted, however, that the regional and central governments have recently tried to pull together resources and are trying to address the needs in regions of the country like Somali and Oromia, particularly by rallying donors like the WFP. Aid agencies in Africa have also complained the crisis in Ukraine is drawing attention and money away from countries on the African continent. The policy advisor added the damage caused by the delayed response is irreversible and it could take years, if it happens at all, for those affected to recover. Aside from drawing attention from the drought, Ethiopia's civil war has itself been a major cause of humanitarian crises. In March, the government said it had called a humanitarian ceasefire and would allow aid into the northern region of Tigray, where it is fighting separatist forces. William Davison is a senior analyst covering Ethiopia for the International Crisis Group, a Belgian-based research group.
Currently, despite the humanitarian truce, there still seems to be around one convoy of aid reaching Tigray per week. So that is nothing like the unrestricted access for humanitarian agencies that's needed. And we should also note that there has been no move by the federal government yet to restore vital public services to Tigray, including banking, telecoms, and electricity.
The number of people in need of humanitarian assistance in the north, combined with those likely to be affected by the drought in the south, brings the total to almost 12.5 million Ethiopians in need of help, according to UN figures. The National Disaster Risk Management Commission of Ethiopia, a branch of the Ethiopian government, did not immediately respond to a request for comment. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga, and that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs and Music from our African collection. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Let's begin with the CAF Champions League, where holders Al Ahly progressed to the semi-finals with a 3-2 aggregate victory over Morocco's Raja Club Athletic, following a 1-1 second leg draw in Casablanca on Friday night. Al Ahly remain on course for a third consecutive African title. They will take on Algeria's ES Satif in the semi-finals. Satif eliminated Esperance of Tunisia with a 1-0 aggregate score. On Saturday, Petro de Luanda also progressed to the semi-final after drawing 1-1 with South Africa's Mamelodi Sundowns. They advance on a 3-2 aggregate score. In the 2023 Nations Cup, 48 countries have been split into 12 qualifying groups of four, with the top two in each group reaching the finals. However, hosts Ivory Coast are guaranteed a spot at the tournament next year. The hosts are drawn against Zambia, Comoros, and Lesotho, and whoever among the three finishes highest will qualify. Egypt, record seven-time winners of the tournament, have been drawn alongside Guinea, Malawi, and Ethiopia. Holder Senegal will face Benin, Mozambique, and Rwanda. Meanwhile, Kenya and Zimbabwe were included in the draw, despite being banned from international football by FIFA. Should either country fail to have their suspension lifted 2 weeks before qualifiers begin, then they will be eliminated and their respective groups will be composed of just three teams. In basketball, defending Basketball Africa League champion Zamalek of Egypt beat Cameroon's FAP 77-63 to end the Nile Conference qualifying unbeaten. Zamalek finished top of the table and qualify for the finals in Rwanda next month. Zamalek's Dominican-American player Edgar Sosa was named as the game's most valued player as he finished top scorer with 27 points. In the quarterfinals, Zamalek will face Guinea's Seydou Legacy Athletic Club, who finished fourth in the Sahara Conference qualifying in Senegal in March. FAP will face REG from Rwanda. Early in the week, DR Congo's BC Fukash won their final game of the tournament by beating South Africa's Cape Town Tigers 96-92. Despite their loss, though, Cape Town Tigers finished third and progressed to the quarterfinals, where they will play U.S. Monastra of Tunisia. Angola's Petro Atletico face Morocco's ASL in the quarterfinals. And on a sad note, Kenyan distance runner Damaris Mothe Mutua was stabbed to death in Iten. Kenyan police said they found Mutua's body in a state of decomposition in the Kenyan town. Reuters news agency reports that Mutua's boyfriend, Iskender Hailemariam Foley, is being sought by police. Mutua had represented Kenya at the inaugural Youth Olympic Games in Singapore. She earned a bronze medal in the women's 1,000 meters event. Mutua later switched allegiance to represent Bahrain at senior level competitions. And that's about it for this edition of Netherlands Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. The significance of the expansion of the East African community from 6 states to 7 states by the inclusion of the Democratic Republic of Congo, with its population of 90 million, was explored. And now we hear that there is an attempt to move further. In the first review, it was suggested that the community may want to give itself a top priority by trying to find the underlying reasons for the continuing instability in eastern Congo. Last week, it was announced that President Kenyatta had hosted a summit meeting of the community in Nairobi with the attendance of President Tshisekedi of the DRC and other heads of state. There was not much clarity in Nairobi as to the number of heads of state attending the meeting, except that it was underlined that the president of Rwanda was not in attendance, but will be represented by his foreign ministers. Also, reporters suggested there was secrecy around this summit meeting. Equally, in Goma, in the eastern Congo, surprise was made that no one knew of such a summit meeting because it was not announced by the government in Kinshasa. Be that as it may, the report stated that the summit had decided to set up a security mechanism for eastern Congo to deal with the security problems. It was also stated that there would be meetings in Nairobi with the various rebel groups in eastern Congo to determine whether they could resolve their political difficulties. This is also an important move by the community. One must recall that eastern Congo has always been a major problem for the DRC. The coalition that finally ousted President Mobutu began in eastern Congo with the leadership of the Kabilas, and it was alleged that a number of East African states gave assistance to these rebel forces that ousted Mobutu. And it also must be recalled that despite decades of United Nations peacekeeping force in the DRC, security in the region remains deplorable. So it is good that the community will now try to tackle this problem once and for all. But it is also advisable that before this mechanism is established, the community should consult with the United Nations to determine whether there could be their community security mechanism as well as with United Nations peacekeeping. The UN has had not too good experience with multiple forces in the scene. In Somalia in the 90s, when the UN had its peacekeeping force, there was also a U.S. peacekeeping mechanism that was not under the command of the UN peacekeeping commanders. Equally, in the case of Mali, there is a UN peacekeeping, but also the French government assembled another European security forces. So it has not been very good mixing these things together. So the community should hold serious talk with the UN before concluding the arrangement for security mechanism in Eastern Congo. Whatever it is, one should commend the community for not only trying to promote trade and other development in the community, but also to try to resolve problems in the troubled region of the Congo. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs.
It's Nike E on the beat.
And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
Anamlale, anamlala, na siyo siri. wewe sidanganyi unasema mimi nadanganya. Utasikizaje masikio yako shazidwa na macho yako yanaona vitu na kuna kitu nafanya. Hapo ndo tumefika na kuongelesha nikiona unaona niko kiti haimata kitu nitasema. Tani ya roi naumizwa nasikia wivu nikiona wale wanapendana bila kushukushuku sana. Bila inafaa bila unataka kufanya fanya leo leo kana panda cheo cheo nipande kana shuka basi nianze kutafuta stage ya mind. Yeah, jifanye kama una care pia utaniamini uone vile na kuchange ya mind.
you giving me head swelling.
was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we're on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, including producer Saida Hamdoun, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, no matter how beautiful and well-crafted a coffin might look, it will not make anyone wish for death. I'm your host, Peter Clotte in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
This is VOA News, reporting by remote. I'm Joe Ramsey.